The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I don't anticipate that the Biden administration is going to do in Iraq what they did in Afghanistan. I think they're going to work with Prime Minister Khatami and with the new government to calibrate a continued American presence that causes the least possible concern to Iraqis, but provides the greatest possible support for the Iraqi government to help create that continued independent Iraqi foreign policy and hopefully domestic course.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for November 8th, 2021. The complicated relationship between Iraq and the United States is once again approaching a crossroads. Parliamentary elections held in Iraq last month promise a new government, featuring a new cast of political forces with their own difficult histories with the United States. The United States, meanwhile, is approaching the self-imposed deadline by which it has promised to withdraw U.S. combat troops from the country, even as its diplomatic and military presences in the country have continued to come under attack by Iran-backed militias. To discuss these developments, I hosted a session of Lawfare Live with someone who knows the U.S.-Iraq relationship like few others, Ambassador Doug Silliman, who served as the U.S. Ambassador to Iraq from 2016 to 2019 and was previously the Deputy Chief of Mission and Political Counselor there. We talked about the satirist bloc that appears to have won the recent elections, what other challenges are facing the Iraqi state, and what they all mean for the future of our bilateral relationship. This is an edited recording of that live conversation. A quick note, this conversation took place before the assassination attempt on Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi, which happened this past weekend on Sunday, November 7th. For this reason, this event is not covered. It's the Lawfare Podcast for November 8th, Ambassador Doug Silliman on what's next in U.S.-Iraq relations. So we're talking now a few weeks after just a really major event in Iraq that really did not get much media coverage in the United States, even less so compared to similar prior events, elections, I should say, in Iraq in the past few years, which I think was kind of disappointing because this was a really important election for Iraq in a lot of ways. This was parliamentary elections took place in October of this past year. We still don't have, I think, the fully certified results. I think some of the numbers around the margins are still being certified. But from what we can understand right now, it appears that the big winner out of that election was what is often known as the Sadr's Coalition, a group of parties, primarily individuals following Muqtada al-Sadr, a Shia leader, but a little different from some other Shia leaders in ways that we will get into, that took about over 70 seats. I think 74 is the last count that I saw. After him, we see two parties splitting at about 35 seats each. The Takadum Party, which is a party led by the Speaker of the Parliament, a Sunni figure that's kind of I think a Takadum means Progress Party, something to that effect in Arabic, a newish party, I think, that's just formed last year. And then the State of Law Party, which has really been the kind of crux of a lot of governments. It's the party of former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and his successor as well, and so has been the leader over Iraq in a lot of ways, or at least produced the prime minister of the Iraq in the last few governments. But the big notice is kind of who didn't win seats. The Fatah Coalition, which made major gains in the last major parliamentary election, represents in a lot of ways the popular mobilization forces, or at least the Shia Iran-backed popular mobilization forces and associated militias, lost a lot of seats. It is now, I think, around 17 was the last count I saw, which is a big shift. I guess my question for you is, from the perspective of somebody who's both been following Iraqi politics and understands better than anyone how Iraqi politics intersect with the bilateral relationship, what are the big things that we should be coming out of this in terms of the implications for the bilateral relationship. And part of that, we know, is going to hinge on government formation, which is a thing that's going to take place over several weeks, if not several months. Anybody who's watched Iraq deal with this before knows that. Do we have any sense about what direction that's moving in, or is it just too soon to tell?
Before I actually answer your question, let me give a couple of facts that I think are important as a basis or a prequel to the elections themselves. The first of which was a change to the electoral law. Actually, I should say the first of which was demonstrations in Baghdad in the south of Iraq among mostly Shia youth. Some started in 2018, but they really picked up speed in 2019 and lasted into 2020, despite the rise of COVID in early 2020. This led to basically the removal of the old resignation of the old Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mehdi. And after a lot of thrashing about the agreement to appoint Mustafa Al-Khademi, who is both a sort of journalist and human rights activist and the former intelligence chief of Iraq, an interesting combination, becoming the prime minister about a year and a half ago. The second thing that happened, and also as a fairly direct result of the protests, was a change in the election law. All previous Iraqi elections were essentially traditional parliamentary party list elections by province. So you would vote for a party, not an individual, and the parties would have their candidates ranked 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And depending on what percentage of seats they won, they would determine how many on their list would actually be in parliament. What was new this time is that the country was broken up into electoral districts and people voted for individuals, not parties. And that forced a change in the strategy of dealing with elections. And some parties, like Muqtada Sadr's group, were actually quite successful in finding locally recognized candidates that they could associate with the Sadr party. And an interesting sideline, and as we get into some of the protests against the election results, the Sadrists actually won about 500,000 fewer votes total across the country in these elections than they did in the last elections when I was there in 2018. Even with that, they cracked the code on organizing campaigns and running candidates in sort of first-past-the-post districts and were able to get by far the largest number of seats. So there has always been a debate in Iraqi politics, particularly a strong one since 2010, about on what basis will the president in this parliamentary system choose a party to form the new government. And I'm not going to go into the history, but in general, the practice has become, after the election results are in, the parties that have the largest blocks in the parliament negotiate with each other. They negotiate with each other, not really on a platform. They really negotiate with each other more to divide the spoils of government. And frankly, up to this point in Iraq, all Iraqi governments have been what many Europeans would call governments of national unity. All the major parties, by the end of the day, were included in the government. Their supporters became ministers. Their less senior supporters were put into the bureaucracy in positions from deputy ministers down to sort of, you know, janitors and people who serve tea, all the way through the ministries. And the real question is going to be, will these changes in elections and in the election law and the new distribution of seats in the parliament have a significant impact on politics? So that's the introduction. It is true that the Sadrist bloc has 73, 74 seats. The Electoral Commission is supposed to announce final results after more than 1,000 challenges to the individual results that came out a day or two after the elections, probably in the next week. And the Fatah coalition, led by Hadi al-Amri, but largely composed of politicians in support of or members of the Hashd al-Shaabi, the popular mobilization forces, the mostly pro-Iranian militias that had more than double the seats in the last parliament. And the real winner was Sadr. I'll also note that there was a third party that got in the 30s of seats, and that was one of the Kurdish parties, the Kurdistan Democratic Party of Masoud Barzani. Got just one seat, I think, behind Nouri al-Maliki's State of Law party. So this coupled with two other Kurdish blocs of votes will make sure that the Kurds have the opportunity to be major players in the negotiations. So what I expect to happen, and is happening now, is that Sadr, having more than twice as many seats as every other faction, is traveling around the country and meeting with political leaders, trying to figure out whether or not he can bring those votes from that other party or coalition into his coalition. If he has 73 or 74 votes, he still needs a lot more votes to get to a majority. There are 329 seats. You need 165 members of parliament for just a bare majority. And the question in my mind that I keep jumping around, but one of the questions I've been looking at over a succession of Iraqi elections is, will Iraq at any point go to a more traditional European system of parliamentary elections and government formation, where a group of ideologically aligned parties or practically connected parties in some way will come up with a majority of seats in parliament and leave what the Brits would call a loyal opposition? This is something that has not yet happened in Iraq. All governments have been governments of national unity and, frankly, governments of dividing the spoils of governance among party supporters and the leaders among them. Sadr suggested in the past week that maybe he'd like to have a majority government for the first time in Iraqi history since 2003. And whether that is a shot across the bow of Nouri al-Maliki and the more pro-Iran party, I don't know. But it is possible for him, if he allies with what would be considered moderate but traditional Shia parties, like the party of former Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, Amar al-Hakim's Hikma, Wisdom Movement, Mohammed Halbousi's party, and the Kurds, there are far more than enough votes there to form a government that is mixed Sunni, Shia, and Kurd without having to make any concessions or bring in more pro-Iran parties. So that right now is what's going on. And I simply don't know what Sadr's intent is, whether he really does want to form a majority government, or if that was simply a way to put pressure on smaller parties to get them to demand less to be part of his governing coalition.
That's absolutely fascinating. So a big part of, from what I can tell from the coverage that I've been able to see, and I should say whatever terrible Arabic I once had has now completely dissolved, so I'm relying upon the English language press, which is a handicap in this particular area. But what I can tell is it seems like there's a debate going on around the validity of these elections to some extent, where you have Fatah, or at least parties kind of associated with Fatah and with the popular mobilization forces, the Shia Iran-backed PMFs, I should say, saying pretty quickly after the election happened, after the results, preliminary results came out, this election was a fraud. We don't buy these results. We think there are widespread problems, even though most international observers have said, actually, in fact, this is probably one of the more problem-free elections, although turnout was far, far lower compared to prior elections for a variety of reasons, maybe disenchantment as well as COVID, general insecurity, things like that. How has that entered into these government formation debates? I've seen at least one report recently about State of Law Coalition under Nouri al-Maliki, always a very savvy politician with his kind of finger on the pulse of particularly the Shia street in Iraq, you know, sitting down and having an audience with Fatah parties involving other political elements, that being boycotted by the KDP, the Kurdish party that you mentioned, and Takadum as well. So how is that playing into these dynamics? Like, is this a story about they're trying to be coalition building across those sometimes difficult to bridge sectarian divides? Is this an inner Shia fight? Are there both elements in play? What are the dynamics that we're seeing so far?
Well, the dynamics of this set of elections are actually different than previous elections, because in previous elections, there were really only marginal changes in the strengths of various parties that were going into coalition negotiations. This has actually changed the chessboard significantly. Although Sadr was the largest bloc in the last elections, the number of seats he had more than the second largest bloc was far, far smaller. And I had mentioned earlier that the Sadrists seem to have pursued a very good electoral strategy. And even though they got far fewer votes than they did in 2018, they won with more seats. The opposite is true of Fatah and the Iran-associated militia coalition. They believe that they actually won a larger block of votes than all of the Sadrist candidates put together. And the logic that they use is, well, since we obviously won more votes than the Sadrists, how can they have five times as many seats as we do? There's something wrong here. This election has been fixed. The reality is the Fatah coalition concentrated their candidates and their good candidates in certain districts. They, if you will, wasted their votes. They didn't spread them far enough apart that they could win candidates in a broader range. So this is one of the reasons behind what have been a series of relatively small protests from this group against the election results. A lot of Twitter and Instagram threats against officials of the Higher Electoral Commission. And actually today there has been violence in Baghdad. The coordinating committee of the these Shia militias essentially said, with the Electoral Commission about to announce final results, which we believe are fraudulently obtained, this is our last chance to affect those results and show that the people of Iraq don't accept them. So they called this Last Chance Friday. And there were a couple of demonstrations, probably not very large, that attempted to break into the green zone through two different directions. There was a lot of rock throwing on the parts of the demonstrators. There seems to have been some firing on the part of the security forces trying to keep them out of the green zone. And depending on who you listen to, there were more than 100 people injured. There are reports of people being killed, but the Iraqi Ministry of Health says, no one has been killed to our knowledge, but there have been more than 100 injured. The reality is, this is a minority view. There were not hundreds of thousands of people in the streets protesting the elections. It was probably hundreds of people in the street protesting the elections. And they seem to have been directed more by militia leaders than by some larger popular sentiment. And this goes back again to a point I made earlier about the demonstrations that took place across Baghdad in the south in 2019 and 2020. One of the things that the demonstrators were really protesting against was what they consider a lack of an Iraqi national identity. One of the slogans that they used extensively across the country was Nurid Watan, which means we want a country, we want a nation, which was, I guess, a linguistic plea for an Iraq of which they could be proud. The real undertone of that was also, we don't want other countries interfering in Iraq's affairs. We don't want the United States interfering, and we certainly don't want these Iranian-supported militias, which are beginning more and more to act like criminal gangs in our towns and in our neighborhoods and in our villages. So I think that there was a significant backlash against candidates who clearly tied themselves to a policy that was not an Iraqi nationalist or a patriotic Iraqi policy, if you will. And that is one of the reasons I think that the Fatah Alliance, the alliance of Shia militia parties, did comparatively poorly. I think a lot of the votes that would have gone to that, may have gone to that coalition 4 years ago, ended up going to Nouri al-Maliki's State of Law Party. Nouri al-Maliki is not really a militia leader, but he is definitely a Shia nationalist. So there may have been people who still believe that Iraq's identity ought to be Shia more than other sects or religions, but who were beginning to get tired of what they saw as very local interference by militias, which had gotten a bit too big for their britches, and they were interfering in local governance. So I think part of the story here is an Iraqi population which is dissatisfied with government at the very basic level of provision of services, an Iraqi population that no longer wants to see the United States or Iran fighting over Iraq. They want to see an Iraqi government that takes independent stands, that works for the benefit of Iraqis, and that does not lean either to the West or to the East, but tries to set an independent Iraqi path going forward. And that's, again, that is a new factor that's a very big conceptual factor, but it, I think, has drawn a lot of people away from traditional parties. I will point out that there were 9 or 10 members of a party called Imtidad, which is translates as extension, but it's sort of an extension of the protests. It's the first time that a new party that is populist, like these demonstrations were, has really won anything in Iraqi elections. And there are as many as 40 independent candidates who may or may not already be ideologically or through some tribal or family affiliation tied to some of these other parties. But there may be a lot more political free agents in the formation of the next government. The Imtidad movement, the protest party, has already announced that they will not participate in government and they want to be part of the opposition. It'll be interesting to see whether, one, anybody can court them to be part of the government, and two, if they remain part of an opposition, what do they see their role and what will they actually accomplish? So it is, I think Iraqi politics has gotten very, very interesting in this electoral cycle for all of the reasons that we have discussed up to this point.
That's fascinating. You anticipated my next question, which was exactly about this movement. But I want to zoom in on another one of the parties here, probably because we have our audience. It's one, a group that's changed perhaps from what people may have changed, at least somewhat from what people have certain expectations and assumptions about. And that is the Solderist movement. I think a lot of Americans, particularly people who have had their careers or lives touch in Iraq in various regards, which is a lot of Americans over the last 20 years, think of Muqtada al-Sadr and the Solderist movement most closely associated with Jaish al-Mahdi, a violent, another militia, Shia militia that was actively engaged in violent opposition to U.S. military presence throughout 2000s period up until 2011, 2012, really, particularly earlier that during some really aggressive periods. And so sometimes this group gets kind of lumped in, I think, in the popular imagination with certain other armed Shia movements. But it's actually always been a little bit different ideologically and politically. And in the last 10 years, seems to have taken attack in a much more interesting, novel approach towards a more nationalist and particularly anti-corruption sort of narrative being kind of big pillars of their rhetoric and their ideology. Tell us a little bit more about what is the Solderist plank? What is their platform that allowed them to make these sorts of gains in addition to the kind of strategic campaigning that you noted, that kind of evolution and strategy that they've pursued? And what does that mean for the relationship with the United States, a group that still, has obviously a very difficult history with, but nonetheless may share some common interests in terms of limiting Iranian influence, if nothing else?
I mean, Scott, it's a really good and a very crucial question for American interests in Iraq going forward. It is clear to me that Muqtada al-Sadr, pretty soon after the U.S. intervention in 2003, turned into an anti-American activist. So he is most definitely rhetorically, and back then using his militia against American and British forces that he considered occupying forces, he has been very much against the direct intervention of foreign powers. At the same time, he was also flitting back and forth between Qom in Iran and trying to see what support he could get from Iran without necessarily making himself subordinate to an Iranian agenda the way that some other militia groups have done. And I think that this part of his activism, which has been relatively consistent now for almost 20 years, is what came through in the elections. And his electoral campaign this time was really rhetorically about Iraq being for Iraqis. And he excoriated the United States at every opportunity, and he still plays off his rhetorical anti-Americanism. But he also was very cautious in saying anything positive about Iran. He talked about the power of militias, which were beginning to dominate Iraqi lives in ways that they did not appreciate. That was seen as an indirect criticism of Iran. And he has talked a lot about the need for Iraqi policies, both foreign and domestic, that are focused on the good of Iraqis. So this campaign that he ran, more so than in previous electoral terms, was focused on a patriotic Iraqi agenda, or at least patriotic Iraqi rhetoric. So I think that's probably the main change. It was a change in the tone of his campaign. I will note that about 3 weeks ago, Sadr issued a statement in which he said he would be willing to work with any government that was not interfering in the affairs of Iraq, which is maybe the first time that he has said that without a direct reference to how much he hates American interference. And the way that I read that was, if he is considering playing a greater role in governance, he realizes he may have to pragmatically find a way to deal with the United States, and he has to begin to justify to his supporters and people who are knee-jerk anti-American why he might deal with the United States. I will also say from my experience back, especially when I was the head of the political section, all the Solderist members of the parliament, Solderist political activists, were under strict orders never to talk to an American diplomat and not talk to an American if you could possibly avoid it, unless that person was an Iraqi American who was also a Solderist. And even then, they'd be a little bit suspect because of that American hyphenated title.
It's a small part of the Venn diagram at that point.
A very small part of the Venn diagram. And this was difficult to dealing with the parliament, for example, where one of the deputy speakers was actually a member of parliament from the Solderist group. So the question will be, has Sadr decided at some level that a strong Iraqi agenda that he hopes to pursue in a new government will actually, he will actually permit people in his movement, if not he himself, to deal with it with the United States Embassy, with American companies, for the benefit of Iraq. And that's how he would define it. One other question that Sadr has got to answer going forward is whether or not he really wants his movement to be to take on the reins of governance. After all of the previous elections, and particularly in 2018, when he was the largest bloc, he was careful to say that we do not want the reins of government. And it's clear that he wanted to stay outside of governance, where he could continue to be a political gadfly. He could put pressure on people inside the government to do things that he wanted. As a negotiator of the coalition, he could make sure that his supporters had a significant number of high-level postings in the new government. But he himself could remain above the fray and not take any of the blame if the government was unable to provide services or jobs or electricity, water, all the things that Iraqis are demanding. There are some indications that he is willing to have someone from his movement run as a prime minister, but they're still very, very sketchy. And I think the outcome of negotiations that will now begin won't end until sometime next year, will help him make up that decision. If he decides that he wants to be part of or the leader of a majority government, perhaps that could come more quickly, because all you have to do is get above that 165 MP threshold, and you'd like a little cushion on that. But if, again, he wants to try to negotiate this government of national unity so that you do not have marginalized guys with guns from the Fatah faction or from State of Law or other parts of the electorate, if they feel that they're being excluded, you've seen the first reactions to the election results being some relatively minor violence, but some significantly heated rhetoric. If they are excluded from the reins of power, and particularly if any of their people would be kicked out of government and their government sinecures under a new government, this could cause significant problems as well. So there are a lot of questions that have to be answered. The only thing I can say is that the United States has got to take Sadr seriously. He is in the driver's seat politically. He is anti-American, but he is anti-American in a way that really isn't necessarily going to be against American interests, particularly if he wants to stay on the pattern that, to some extent, Haider al-Abadi and particularly Mustafa al-Kadhimi, the current prime minister, caretaker prime minister, has been on, to try to create an independent Iraq-oriented foreign policy and try to rebuild Iraq as a brand, if you will, with Iraq expanding relationships with the Arab states of the Gulf, with Jordan and Egypt, with Iraq playing a mediator between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and Iraq hosting a major Middle Eastern summit, including Emmanuel Macron, to talk about the larger areas of the region. And this is one thing that Khadami has done relatively effectively, is positioned Iraq internationally and regionally as, again, a potential positive, a source of stability and mediation, not just a source of discord and potential instability.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. I want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers.
that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
Well, that's the perfect pivot to the line of questions I want to move to, which is focusing on the United States and how this impacts, because you've navigated that intersection of Iraqi domestic politics and U.S. relationship. Of course, we know the Biden administration earlier this year over the summer committed to withdrawing U.S. combat troops from Iraq by the end of the year. That, you know, that came under some criticism, I think, of people saying, well, that's not really much of a withdrawal. You know, it just means you're going to shift people around from one column to another. Although I kind of suspect there's actually a little bit more substance behind that than people are giving it credit for in terms of the types of activities the United States will be doing. But that itself is the end of a really multi-year process that we've seen take place, I would say probably since the, most notably since the Soleimani killing in early 2020, where you saw the spike in Iraqi popular opposition to U.S. military presence activities in the country, or at least elite Iraqi opposition, popular opposition, you know, always harder to judge to some extent, and leading to this conscious dialogue process of people saying, yes, Trump administration said, yes, we're going to work towards drawing down, work towards limiting this presence. But now we've actually got a deadline to accomplish something. What that is, isn't exactly clear. What are the dynamics that's driven that process, and how does that interface with this election moment? What kind of momentum does that give us leading into this new government that's coming out of this most recent election?
Well, the dynamic is that in the immediate aftermath of the killing of Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Mohandas, the Iraqi militia leader by the United States in January of 2020. The Iraqi parliament, with almost all Kurds and almost all Sunnis boycotting, passed what is essentially a non-binding resolution asking the government to remove all foreign forces from the country. It was designed to get the Americans out and to get the Americans out immediately, and it was designed to, but it was not passed as legislation. It's more, you know, sort of a sense of the Senate resolution with just as much validity, but it was a shot across the bow of the United States. It was probably the Khatami government that has changed the way that Iraqis look at this, because Khatami said, we, of course, don't want American combat forces in the country anymore. So I will work with the United States to make sure that all of their combat forces are removed. The reality, which I've repeated in many different places, is that when I was still ambassador in 2018, most American combat forces had already left the country. And frankly, there weren't that many there to begin with. I would say probably since I left, there couldn't have been more than a few dozen people actually who had combat roles. And even those were not with guns in their hands on the front lines going in and trying to take out ISIS cells anywhere in the country. The role had substantially already changed to one of advising and assisting. And the assisting is in terms of analyzing intelligence, helping to Iraqis to design the kinds of raids and exploit the intelligence that they found after raids that could then continue on and be a virtuous intelligence and military cycle to put more pressure on ISIS. The reality is that the Iraqis still need significant American assistance, but it does not have to be assistance that is provided by Marines on the ground or Delta Force troops on the ground. The thing that probably will be the most useful for the Iraqis is some sort of continued American air support. The Iraqis have their own ISR surveillance platforms. They've got their own aircraft, both F-16s and less capable and less expensive offensive or attack or ground support aircraft that they can use to help support the army. And they've begun to actually learn how to integrate the use of their land and their air forces in a much better way. And some of the comments that have come out of the Pentagon in the past year since that resolution was passed essentially say Iraq has made some significant progress in pretty much everything that they do as a military. The experience of fighting with ISIS for 2.5 years, driving it from the country, not depending upon American or coalition soldiers to do that, but only using us as assistants, has given them an esprit de corps and confidence and experience that they simply did not have before. All of that said, I'm pretty certain that would be in Iraq's interest to keep some Western military forces in the country, whether they are called American, whether they are called coalition, whether they are part of a NATO training mission, whatever is most politically acceptable. Because my experience after 2011 was when the U.S. forces left at the end of 2011, we no longer provided training or mentoring or help to most of the Iraqi army. And the Iraqi army fairly quickly, under pretty bad leadership and management, both by Prime Minister Maliki and the military leadership, deteriorated to the extent that when ISIS came across the border from Syria in 2014, a lot of the Iraqi army simply melted away. And people, when confronted with Toyota Hilux pickup trucks with a bunch of guys in the back with AK-47s, Iraqi soldiers in M1, A1 main battle tanks, who could have destroyed that truck with just a 50 caliber machine gun on the top, abandoned their tanks because they were victims of ISIS propaganda. They were afraid that if they lost, they would be beheaded. They would be declared as apostate, as heretics. And it was ISIS propaganda that helped rip apart the esprit de corps of the Iraqi army. Had there been more continued Western American NATO mentoring and assistance, I think that would have not deteriorated nearly as quickly. And I think it's important, particularly in looking at what happened in Afghanistan, if a very small number of coalition and NATO forces, including some Americans, remain in Iraq, help the Iraqis to continue to develop the best minds, the best practices, develop an esprit de corps, I think the Iraqi army can get stronger and become a good national army. And the need for this kind of outside assistance would probably eventually end. I fear that if we were to withdraw all of our forces from Iraq, Most of the rest of the coalition and NATO would do the same. And it wouldn't be as bad as you see in Afghanistan because the situations are different. But I think you might again see a slow deterioration of the quality of the Iraqi army and security forces, as you saw between 2011 and 2014. So a long, complicated answer. But I think that most in the Iraqi military, most Iraqi politicians who are not pushing either a straight Shia nationalist agenda or a much more veiled Iranian agenda also recognize that Iraq needs a Western balance to already significant Iranian influence in the country. And I think most Iraqis would probably like, or I'll say a majority of Iraqis would like to see the continued presence of some Western military with the role of assisting the Iraqi military, but not doing things for them.
So that's exactly what I want to ask you about next is what can this look like? What is your sense of what the political parameters as well as the kind of U.S. commitment? So no combat troops. We know that that is a category that I do think puts limits on what U.S. troops will be doing, but it's also maybe not as broad or narrow. There's a little flex about, well, what is a combat troop? What is somebody providing support and assistance, training, advising and assistance, things like that. And we now have what appears to be on paper, although I don't know the extent to which it's been fully stood up yet, a pretty robust NATO training cell that looks like it's got full parliamentary approval as of earlier this year or last year. I can't remember exactly when that happened. Definitely a notable event, a project that's kind of had starts and stops a number of times over the last 10 years. But this is a pretty robust model compared to the earlier ones that I remember seeing. What is that going to look like after, you know, in 2022 and onward? What is the U.S. coalition NATO military presence most likely to look like, or what model seems to have the most sustainability in your view by a balancing what the political environment will allow and what the actual operational needs are?
I'm not really sure what that's going to look like yet, because I think it will depend to a large extent on the formation and the opinions of the new government and the new prime minister. So if Muqtada Sadr becomes prime minister, I think it'll be more difficult for him to accept anything that has an American label, but he might actually understand from some of his advisors that the military needs the help, in which case it might lead to more preeminence for a NATO training mission, for example, or maybe a Canadian or an Australian would take up leadership. Another possibility is something that we did between 2011 and 2014. We had a relatively small military presence inside the embassy as military attachés who continued to conduct small amounts of training and small amounts of assistance work, particularly with the Iraqi Counterterrorism Service. And that support for the CTS was one of the reasons, I think, that helped the CTS be the premier organization in fighting ISIS and the premier organization that did not fold in the face of relatively light ISIS assaults inside Iraq. So I think that the idea of mentoring and training and building esprit de corps is probably almost as important as turning around an intelligence cycle or learning how to effectively plan interoperability of land forces with air forces. Those things can be done. The Iraqis are doing better on that. What they need to work on is how to keep your force unified, keep them on the same path. And the Western militaries have been able to help Iraqi army do that most effectively. So I don't know what the label will be on forces. I think the forces will be a relatively modest group of forces. And as you probably remember from your time in Iraq, I don't know, for every one soldier or officer that has a role, the number of soldiers who are there simply to provide force protection for that one soldier is quite significant. So if you have 100 people in country, I would imagine probably 80 or 85 of them are force protection and logistics support. It bumps up the numbers, but it also means that it's expensive and it takes a lot of people to accomplish small tasks when you're using U.S. military models. A little bit less expensive if you're using NATO models or using other allies to do particular pieces of the work and the training, as we have during the course of the fight against ISIS. The coalition was real. Spain, Italy, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Denmark, Australia, I mean, a lot of other countries had significant roles in training and support and mentoring of the military, the counterterrorism service, the police. And it was a true useful and effective and efficient coordination among the groups through the Combined Joint Task Force, Operation Inherent Resolve, even though it had that, you know, weird American acronym label on the top, it was much more than just an American military operation, although most Iraqis didn't really understand the extent to which other countries played an incredibly important part in that training and mentoring.
One of the places where we have seen during the Biden administration and the Trump administration before it, U.S.-Iraqi relations really jump back on the front pages and become a major national issue again, is in the continued security challenges between Iraqi militias, primarily Iran-backed Shia militias, targeting U.S. military and diplomatic facilities and personnel, or often Iraqi military facilities with U.S. personnel located on them. In a handful of cases, you know, killing and injuring people, and the United States responding with military force, airstrikes against and drone strikes against targets of those groups. The Biden administration has done this twice after the Trump administration came in with an aggressive move in that direction, the Soleimani strike being a big one, presumably a pretty aggressive attack for a while, then kind of calming down in part because I think coronavirus and other things kind of calmed the general situation. But the Biden administration has to do this twice now. Its first strike kind of consciously in what I read, and I think a lot of people observed as a thought, was a deliberately conservative move hitting Kitab Hezbollah, who's believed to be responsible for certain rocket attacks on U.S. personnel facilities outside of Iraq, in Syria, in a move that seemed to be calibrated to be a little bit more sensitive to the domestic political situation in Iraq. Second airstrikes, though, hit KH targets both in Syria and in Iraq, a return to a practice the Trump administration had pursued. How do these sorts of actions play out in Iraqi public opinion and political dynamics? Are they detrimental? Is the return on investment on deterrence or on eliminating capability balanced out by the cost of to the sustainability of the overall military presence and U.S.-Iraq bilateral relationship? Obviously, those are hard things to weigh, but how are these things perceived and what are their political ramifications?
It's a difficult question to answer because it depends on who you are, what kind of Iraqi you are. If you are an Iraqi who very much supports either a Shia nationalist agenda, but an Iraqi Shia agenda, or who believes in this Iranian revolutionary expansion, which many of the militias do, it doesn't really matter where you are hit by the United States or Israel or any other country. All of these are attacks on Iraq, and they're horrific. I think for most Iraqis, particularly since the popular mobilization forces, although part of the Iraqi security forces, have no authorization to operate outside of the borders of Iraq. If you tell an Iraqi that there were people from Kataib Hezbollah or Saab Ahl al-Haq killed in a raid in Syria, they sort of say, okay, what were they doing in Syria? And a place to gauge this is actually the southern Iraqi town of Najaf, which may be the world's largest cemetery. And it is the place where many, many Shia who consider themselves or their families consider them to be martyrs to a religious cause hope to be buried. And this cemetery, and those of you who are out there should Google videos and pictures of this cemetery. I mean, Arlington Cemetery in Washington, in Arlington, Virginia, would fit in a tiny corner of this, you know, dozens of square mile large cemetery outside of Najaf. The numbers of burials of Iraqis and Iranians who were killed in Syria and the remains brought back to be buried in Najaf was quite large. And Iraqis were beginning to notice, we're not actually fighting inside Iraq. We're not taking casualties from attacks from ISIS inside Iraq. Where are these people fighting? And I think this was one of the reasons that some Iraqis were concerned about the increasing strength of the militias and the independent action that the militias were taking, contravening the government's policies. I was always concerned, and I expressed my concern very directly to Iraqi government and military officials, that continued Iraqi support through a formal Iraqi security service, the Popular Mobilization Forces, inside Syria against the orders of the government in support of Bashar al-Assad or Hezbollah, would eventually get Iraq in some sort of war or conflict with Israel, which began a couple of years ago. And Israel has hit far more targets of the PMF inside Syria than the United States has. I think the easiest answer to your question is, as long as there is the targets are outside of Iraq, the political backlash inside Iraq is relatively smaller. When the United States attacks Iraqis inside Iraq, there is this visceral concern is not a strong enough word. This visceral anger of many Iraqis just because they feel that their borders have been violated. And this is something that the Biden administration and all administrations have to take into account. How can you maintain deterrence? How can you reduce the capabilities of these groups in terms of logistics and planning and communications operating only outside of Iraq? So this is a very, it's always been a difficult question for military planners. What kinds of targets could you hit that would have an impact? And what is a proportional response to a rocket hitting a base that kills an American contractor? I mean, how do you weigh that response? One thing I will say when we're talking about this, particularly in light of the not very pretty American withdrawal from Afghanistan 2 months ago, that the Biden administration and the people in the Biden administration don't see Iraq as Afghanistan. The extent to which Americans or President Trump would want to get us out of the forever wars in the Middle East, people talked about Iraq, they talked about Afghanistan, but they are seen as two separate, completely separate conflicts, two completely separate sets of American interests. And I think you can make a strong case, and I particularly since Vice President Biden was the desk officer for Iraq during much of the Obama administration. He knows Iraq far better than he knows Afghanistan. He knows the strategic cost of abandoning Iraq. He knows the strategic cost of going in too hard in Iraq because he lived it during the Obama administration. I don't anticipate that the Biden administration is going to do in Iraq what they did in Afghanistan. And going back to your original question, I think they're going to work with Prime Minister al-Khadami and with the new government to calibrate a continued American presence that causes the least possible concern to Iraqis, but provides the greatest possible support for the Iraqi government to help create that continued independent Iraqi foreign policy and hopefully domestic course.
We saw a pretty difficult internal conflict between the central government of Iraq and Kurdish authorities in 2017 after the end of the ISIS offensive that obviously as well, you were ambassador as well. So you may not be able to talk about it too, in the same way that you could talk about other things. But, you know, since then we've seen a little bit more schism's too strong, but a fracturing of the Kurdish political scene. The two traditional parties, PUK and KDP, have been wrestling with each other. There have been, you know, at least one other major party that at different points has kind of stepped onto the scene. KDP, obviously, still a major seat holder in the most recent election, the kind of successor to the PUK. I don't know if it's the right way to say it necessarily, but got a number of seats as well, but about half as many, I think around 17 or 18. The last count I saw. How has that fit into this new political scheme? Are the Kurds substantially weakened because they no longer have the disputed internal territories they lost in the 2017 conflict to the same extent? Or is there still a very strong independent Kurdish identity and political weight that counterbalances the central government?
I mean, there is still a very strong Kurdish identity, and there is still that Kurdish identity generally, but not always, is stronger than the desire to work with people in the south of Iraq to strengthen the position of one of the other factions. Factionalism and conflict between Kurdish factions is not new. I mean, recent conflict goes back to the 90s when there were shooting wars between different parts of the Kurdistan, the Kurdish Peshmerga. And as I said in my analysis of seats in the parliament, in choosing a prime minister, if particularly the leadership of the KDP decides that they want to be a kingmaker, that they would like to participate in a majority government, and that they would like to try and marginalize those more nationalist Shia or pro-Iran parties, which they say both publicly and privately they would like to do, it is well within their power to unify the votes of the three or four Kurdish blocs. And the KDP bloc is essentially as large as Maliki's bloc. And the PUK Goran bloc is about half that. But there's also a new generation bloc, which is another 9 or 10 seats, which doesn't really like either the PUK or the KDP, but are still Kurds and might be quite happy to align with a more centrist Iraqi national liberal, if you will, government, instead of bringing everybody from all political stripes into the government. The Kurds can play a significant role. Up to this point, most Kurds have decided, however, that they want to find out before they jump to one side or another, who are the Shia parties going to focus on and give the nod to, you know, try to form a government. And they have not really taken the initiative to be part of that conversation. And frankly, by and large, I think that the Sunnis have had less of a part as well, although they have somewhat fewer seats than the Kurds. This could be a part of the current government formation process that could change the future dynamic of Iraq. If Kurds, if Kurdish politicians believe they would like to play a major role, they will partner with Sadr and they will partner with other people that Sadr likes, possibly including Mohammed Halusi and his Taqaddum party, they've got the votes for a government. And they could exclude the people who they theoretically and who they don't like and who they've been complaining about for a number of years. It's a political decision that the Kurds will have to make. And the Kurds are always weighing what is the political dynamic inside Iraqi Kurdistan versus the political dynamics inside Iraq with other parties and the relationship of the two major Kurdish factions with Baghdad. So it's beyond triangulation. It's a very complicated political equation that they have to work out. But it is a role they could play. Many used to say that the Kurds could be kingmakers. I think it's probably not that simple. But the Kurds could fairly early in the process, by committing to a path, put a lot of weight behind it. And by using their political strength and their relationships with people like Mohammed Halusi, they could probably put a lot of pressure or at least move that political path closer to realization. In past government formation processes, they have not chosen to do that. And it'll be interesting to see if they do this time around with a relatively larger share of the non-Sadrist votes.
I want to close with one question. In thinking about how to navigate this bilateral relationship and giving advice on that to your successors, to other people working in the White House and the State Department about how to do that, what are the touchstones that they should be looking at? What is the vision for a role of this relationship? There was a time when, you know, we had a very robust vision of what U.S. and Iraq cooperation would look like after, you know, the initial, after 2008, the security agreement, and that's kind of changed over time. Then we had a much more pared down relationship prior to the ISIS intervention. Then obviously ISIS intervention had a much more robust operating relationship, but that was for a limited purpose that has now not entirely passed, but has waned. What are we looking for a long-term relationship? What can we realistically expect? And what are the kind of North Stars to use to guide us in navigating in that direction?
Well, I'm really glad that you asked that question, Scott, because I kind of wanted to start this conversation in a totally different tack. But I know this is interesting, and the politics and the militias are the topic of the moment. What really concerns me is the economic health of Iraq in the future. Iraq is obviously a rich country. It's got amazing hydrocarbon resources. Even though it has water shortages, the water shortages are not nearly as bad as its neighbors, including Iran. Iraq also has 40 million people, and Iraq could either be the beginnings of a breadbasket for the Middle East, a center for stability and mediation, and a center for learning, as Iraq, I mean, Mustan Sariya University is more than 1,000 years old there in Baghdad. There's a respect for education and work in Iraq that doesn't always exist in every place that I've lived, and particularly in the region. It's really important that Iraq wrestle with the reality of a very quickly growing youth population. One of the things that I learned, or my very good staff explained to me when I was in Baghdad, is that by 2023 or 2024, there will be about 1 million young Iraqis graduating from high school or graduating from university every year, most of whom will enter the job market. And most of them will expect a government job, a government sinecure. And the government, in the last time that I had good numbers, probably created between 40 and 50,000 jobs in 2018. They've since had larger numbers, but there's no way that the Iraqi government can afford, as a government, to use its hydrocarbons resources to employ everybody. The problem is the lack of the ability of Iraqis to open businesses, to start businesses, for those businesses to prosper. There is corruption in the government. There is corruption in militias, which in many villages and cities act as criminal organizations that extort money from profitable businesses. And there really needs to be a significant effort by the Iraqi government to probably gradually strip away the causes of corruption, and maybe more importantly, the opportunities for mid-level government officials to extract bribes through just excessively regulated government bureaucracy. I see the economic piece as important as the political piece, because I can see if there are a million new Iraqis in the job market who want to get married, have children, buy a home, have a car, improve their lives, and they're all stymied, you will begin to see more demonstrations like you saw in 2018, 2019, and 2020. Young Iraqis, and in those cases, mostly young Shia Iraqis in the South, who are dissatisfied with their quality of life and blame a series of corrupt and inefficient governments that have prioritized political payback for their supporters to providing services and good policy for Iraqis. So this is all sort of linked, but in my long-term fear for Iraq is that if Iraqi governments don't begin to more seriously take economic reforms, find ways to support the private sector, and this doesn't mean having American and European contracts. It means letting Iraqis form businesses, let them expand without penalizing them in an inordinate way. I fear that we will see more social stability in Iraq, more protests, and you will see a government that is increasingly unable to provide even the basics that most people demand. And that's my concern. Whether Iran intervenes, whether Qataib Hezbollah continues to supply missile parts to the Assad regime and to Hezbollah are important issues, which could lead to regional conflict. But I'm also afraid that a flood of refugees out of Iraq, most would want to go to Europe, would look very much like what happened between 2011 and 2015 to Syria, with millions of people leaving the country to neighboring countries. And Iraq is not yet on the verge of that, but in 5 years it might be. So I would recommend to my colleagues, and I've said publicly, and I've said privately to some of my friends and colleagues who are still in government, this is something that you need to do, and it's something the United States cannot do alone. We need our European and Asian partners. We need to work within the framework of the IMF, the World Bank, and various other international organizations to convince Iraqis how they can step by step improve their economy and the performance of their economy for young Iraqis. So it's very, very difficult task to perform. But I think that is probably the biggest issue facing Iraq going forward. And I would like to see the United States put more of our energy into the broad range of economic reform and economic development in Iraq, because I think that's really what's necessary for Iraq to 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now be a source of stability as opposed to a source of instability.
All right. Well, thank you. Those are really useful observations. Our time is unfortunately up. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us here today on Lawfare Live / the Lawfare Podcast. Every time we get to talk to you, we learn so much and we really appreciate it.
Scott, thank you very much. Thank you to Lawfare and everybody who's responsible for getting this done.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to rate and share the Lawfare Podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you might be listening. To gain access to our weekly Lawfare Live online discussions, an ad-free version of our podcast, and other benefits, please consider supporting Lawfare as a material supporter on our Patreon account at www.patreon.com/lawfare. This podcast was engineered by Kara Chalin of Goat Rodeo and edited by Jen Patcha Howell. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.